You're listening to Consider This on KCYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KCYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both places. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448. Or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is Eric Potashnick, Julius Rabinowitz Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Brown University. He is one of three co-authors of Unhealthy Politics, The Battle Over Evidence-Based Medicine. The authors argue that many common medical treatments in the U.S. are not based on sound science and shed light on why the government's response to that situation has been so inadequate and why efforts to improve the evidence base of U.S. medicine continue to cause so much political controversy and public trepidation. Eric Potashnick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you. So the book takes on an issue in medicine that, while it has had occasional wide media coverage, it remains mostly in the background of current debate and discussion, which has been dominated by repeal and replace, obviously. And that hidden issue is the evidence-based kind of self-correcting and self-monitoring nature of the profession of medicine, doctors and the societies to which they belong, insurance companies, Medicare, and the politics of all of that. And I'd like you to please start by articulating that general problem, including some examples, and then briefly introduce why it matters, and then we'll start to get into some of the details.
Sure. So I think you're right. We have paid a lot of attention to repeal and replace about the Affordable Care Act and extending insurance coverage to Americans, which is certainly a very important issue. The issue we're talking about is one that, as you suggest, many Americans are unaware of, and that really has to do with the quality of our health care and the efficiency and cost effectiveness of our health care. So in the United States, we spend about 18% of gross domestic product in healthcare. That's much more than any other country in the world. And I think the frustrating part for many Americans is that our outcomes are not consistently superior. We don't always do better than other countries, even though we spend so much more. And there's a variety of reasons for that. In part, that's partly because our prices are very high. We have excessive administrative costs. But another part of the problem, and the problem that we highlight in our book, is that many of the treatments that patients receive are actually not as effective as they could be. Medicine is not always based on sound science. And in fact, some experts believe that less than half of all the medical care that patients receive is based on adequate evidence about its effectiveness for patients with different conditions. Many treatment options have never been compared head-to-head with alternatives. So to just give you an example and make this more concrete, let's say that you're a patient with back pain. There might be a variety of ways to treat your condition. You might have surgery. There could be physical therapy. Maybe there's a drug regimen. But the question that you want to know is which one really works best for you. And the sort of dirty little secret of the American medical system is that we have a medical guesswork problem, because the answer is often we don't know the answer to that question. And that means that doctors often don't have the hard evidence they need to make the most informed treatment decisions. They may rely on what they learned a long time ago in medical school, on norms in their local practice area, what other doctors in their town do, or even on conjecture and anecdotes. And this is something that I think that a lot of Americans are unaware of. And there are a variety of reasons for this problem. First of all, we have, of course, the Food and Drug Administration, which evaluates pharmaceutical products and medical devices. But in many cases, FDA review isn't really set up to ensure that patients get the most effective treatments. For example, when it looks at a new drug, the FDA is typically looking at whether the drug works better than a placebo, not whether it works better than an alternative drug or other treatments for the same condition. We also don't have an FDA for surgery. So there could be a new surgical operation that begins to be used by doctors that has not necessarily been proven to be more effective than less invasive alternatives. And as a result, treatments can diffuse into widespread practice before they're rigorously evaluated, and sometimes these treatments have real risks for patients. So this is a problem that I think we have to be concerned about, if we're concerned about healthcare quality, if we're concerned about making sure that we get best value for money, just making sure that patients know what the best options are and that they're choosing the treatment that really will work best for their condition.
And one of the impacts of all of this is that patient care and the outcomes for patients is really less than it could be. It's not optimal at all.
Yeah. So what we began our study some time ago when we saw an incredible randomized controlled trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was back in 2002. And what the study showed was that a very common operation for people who have osteoarthritis of the knee, which was being used very frequently in the U.S., the study found that this common procedure was no more effective than a fake operation in which the surgeon merely pretended to operate. So let me say a little bit more about this, because it was a rather stunning study.
It is.
What happened in the study was there was a common procedure for people who had knee arthritis. They had pain. They were losing joint function. And there was a question about how well this common procedure really worked. And so a team of doctors did a very, very careful study, a gold standard study. It went through all the ethics review boards. And what they did was some of the patients in the study received the real operation, and then some of the patients received a fake operation in which the surgeon merely pretended to operate. And I should be clear that all of the patients in this study knew that there was a chance that they might not get the real operation. There was full disclosure. They went through all the ethics review boards and so on. And what the study found was that the patients that got the real surgery, they did feel better and they did have less pain and their joint function improved. But at the same time, the surgeon, the patient in the study that did not have the real operation, that got the fake operation, they had the same improvement in pain relief and in joint function. And so what this study showed was that the surgery really worked no better than a placebo operation. This is a remarkable kind of rigorous evidence to show that a very important operation really did not rest on a strong evidence base as people had thought. And that, for us, was very eye-opening. It did not occur to us that that kind of thing could happen. And so we were curious. We just wanted to understand better how could this be. So the first thing we did was we asked a series of very simple questions. First of all, why were doctors performing this surgery? And so we went back and we looked at the medical literature. And you don't have to be a doctor to do this. You can read the literature and follow along, if you're careful and put some effort into it. And what we found was that there were a lot of studies that were literally of the sort that I'm a surgeon, I've performed these surgeries, and my patients feel better. And in other words, a lot of these studies were not really rigorous. They don't really meet the standards of high-quality science. So that was the first question that we wanted to ask was, how was it possible that the surgery became popular and diffused widely into practice? And the answer was, it did so without a strong scientific basis. And then what we want to know was, okay, now that this study has been published and it received a lot of attention, it was in, the New York Times and on all the TV stations, how could it not be? It was a kind of blockbuster study. We were interested, how does the U.S. healthcare system then react when you have this kind of study come out? And what we found was that a lot of the medical societies that performed the surgery, they attacked the study, and they tried to maintain Medicare funding for this procedure, and in some ways they treated the doctors that performed the study, they kind of blackballed them in professional circles, as opposed to treating them as people who did an important service for the public of trying to learn more about the quality of the evidence. They focused on trying to maintain reimbursement and coverage of this procedure, and they went to Washington to lobby the government to make sure that any Medicare changes would be minimal and not really eliminate funding for it. And so that was part of the way that we learned that actually evidence does exist in our healthcare system, and we don't want to argue that there's no attention to evidence. There absolutely is, and we are strong believers in science and strong believers in the way in which the American medical system has improved dramatically over the last 50 years. But that in many cases, evidence is either missing and we don't have as strong evidence as we need, and then when evidence is generated, as it was through this New England Journal of Medical study, the uptake, the integration of that evidence to change clinical practice can be very slow because it goes through a process in which there are a variety of interest groups and others that may resist and may try to protect the status quo, even when treatments have been discredited by high-quality studies.
So in investigating that question, you look at three areas. You look at the physicians and the societies in which they belong to and the influence they have on that whole process. You look at the political aspect of it, the politicians and their role in it, and a big part of that is Medicare and what Medicare is doing. And then you look at just the general public's kind of approach to this whole area. So why don't we start to get into some of those a little bit more?
Yeah. So you described it just right. So the book, you know, the U.S. healthcare system is incredibly complicated, and it can be overwhelming for the public and certainly for scholars. And we think it's very important to try to keep your eye on the most important actors. And we argue that three of the actors that are very important are the public and physicians and politicians. And so what we did was perform five national public opinion surveys over the last decade or so. We were interested in trying to understand how ordinary Americans think about these problems of lack of evidence and waste in American healthcare. And we found a few things. First of all, we found Americans absolutely want better information about healthcare. If you ask Americans, would you like to know, you know, how well a particular treatment works? Of course they would. Would you like to be warned if a particular treatment is dangerous? You know, absolutely. But at the same time, we found that Americans are extremely nervous about anything that would interfere with the doctor-patient relationship. The public is really easily spooked. And what we found is that the public has a high degree of trust for very understandable reasons, not only in their personal doctor, but also in the medical profession as a whole. Now, it's true that there has been some loss of faith in the American medical profession over the last few decades, but what I think is important to see is that compared to all the other actors in the American healthcare arena, whether it's government or insurance companies or big drug companies, the medical profession is still the one that the public sees as protecting their patient interests. And the public believes very strongly that no outside group should come between doctors and patients in making treatment decisions. They're worried about government and insurance companies using evidence-based treatment guidelines as a way to control costs and ration care. That's the real death panel scare that we, you know, heard about so much during the debate over the Affordable Care Act. And they're fearful that if there's an effort to impose evidence-based protocols, that they're not going to keep pace with medical innovation. They're going to lead to sort of one-size-fits-all medicine. Now, on the hopeful side, what we also saw was that one way to build support for the kind of reforms that we think are necessary to make American healthcare more quality-oriented, more efficient, more evidence-based, would be to tell Americans that doctors support these reforms. And we found in public opinion that if you tell the average American that these reforms are necessary to improve American healthcare, you can overcome a lot of resistance. And so what we saw that I think is our real takeaway from our public opinion part of the survey is that doctors have a huge opportunity to play a leadership role in moving our very expensive and wasteful and inefficient and often irrational healthcare system to a better place. But then this raises the second key actor that you mentioned, and that's the doctors. And what we found is that the doctors themselves, they believe in the importance of evidence-based medicine. Of course, doctors are very science-oriented, but that support is often in the abstract. And then when it comes to improving practice and making it more scientifically based in their own practice areas, we've often, you know, not seen the kind of leadership that we need. So, for example, there was an initiative, a very, I think, commendable one a few years ago called Choosing Wisely, where it asked for a variety of medical societies this was an initiative of the American Board of Internal Medicine, to try to get the professional societies to identify lists of tests or procedures that, you know, their members might agree are often performed but, you know, might not be based on sound evidence. And what we've seen is that this has had a fairly disappointing impact so far. It has really not had much effect in changing practice patterns. A lot of times, these societies were identifying some of the images and tests and drugs that are little use, but often not ones in their own practice area or not the ones that are really the most remunerative or the ones that are generating the most income. And so it has not really changed practice. And we did some surveys of doctors. In addition to surveying the public, we surveyed doctors. And what we found was that the doctors themselves actually, they want their medical societies to defend treatments in their area, even when scientific studies challenge them. And so we asked, you know, doctors, how do you think your medical society should react if you see a study like the New England Journal of Medicine? Should they just sort of transmit this information to doctors, or should they try to defend the status quo and just try to critique the studies? And in some ways, to our surprise, we found that there was a lot of support among doctors for that kind of role. And I think the takeaway message here is that, you know, American medicine is really based on kind of a social contract. We, you know, citizens, we delegate a lot of autonomy and control over medicine to doctors in exchange for the idea that doctors will use their professional authority to make sure that medicine is really works well for the American public. But the question is, what happens if that social contract isn't working so well? What happens if we see that we do have a lot of inefficiency or in American healthcare, or a lot of bad quality? We're spending a lot of money on treatments that aren't as effective at the same time as we have other Americans that don't have, you know, needed care. We have other Americans that aren't receiving treatments that we know work very well. What happens if the medical societies are not upholding their end of the social contract? The question then becomes, can politicians, you know, police the medical sector and scrutinize it and make sure that doctors are upholding their social contract? And what we found was not so much. That politicians are very, very leery of wading in these waters. They are very, very they're very treacherous waters for politicians. And if the social contract is breaking down, politicians might not be able to correct it so easily.
And that's because it's you talk about how it's really not any particular political gain for them. And that's very much, I think that's part of the argument you make, is that our politicians are very much concerned about getting reelected, and they're very much concerned about the political costs and the political benefits of getting into these things. And they're not so much focused on patient outcomes and effectiveness, even though they might say so.
Yeah, I mean, you might think, well, wait a minute, the American taxpayer has a huge stake in making our healthcare system as efficient and equitable and cost effective as possible. We spend a tremendous amount of money through Medicare and Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, and those programs do a tremendous amount of good for sure. But they are expensive programs, and we want to make sure that they are as effective as possible. And so you would hope that politicians would be good stewards of taxpayer money. The problem is that when you have problems like this, you know, politicians are not much trusted these days, and they are trusted much less than doctors, for example. And so we did a study that looked at what would happen if a study came out and said that a common procedure, say, for heart disease or another area, you know, doesn't work very well. What would happen if a politician takes the side of the science and sort of says, oh, I see this study. I really think that we should, follow the advice of the study and try to make sure that we are using our tax dollars, our insurance dollars more effectively. And what you see is that if the politician takes that stand alone, well, that's fine. The public is totally okay with that. But if the politician is opposed by medical societies in that area, if the cardiologist, for example, were to come out and say, you know, we don't really think that study's right. We know best, and we need to continue these treatments, even if the New England Journal says that this treatment doesn't work so well, the politician will lose public support, is what we found. You can't get on the other side of the doctors with the public, because the public very understandably thinks the doctors know better than the politician. So this is a big problem. It really means that we're going to be reliant on the medical profession to play a leadership role, because politicians have so little support among the public. This is just not a very good area for them to be in. You know, if you're a politician and you want to try to solve problems, you're better off focusing on the needs of Mendocino or something local than trying to wade in these waters. This is not going to be a very good political strategy for you, which helps explain why so few politicians have been leaders in this area.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Eric Potashnick, co-author of Unhealthy Politics, The Battle Over Evidence-Based Medicine. So let's get into the doctor side of this in terms of their opposition. I mean, one of the things for me, it seems like there is a fair amount of kind of two things, I would say, some amount of inertia in the whole kind of medical profession and the system. And then you bring up this other area where, and this might go against the public's trust and understanding of medicine, they do operate out of self-interest.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be very careful here. First of all, I love doctors. I have some of my best friends are doctors. This is not a book against medicine. It's not a book against mainstream medicine or in science. I don't think that most doctors go into medicine simply for profit incentives. I think most doctors overwhelmingly care about patient welfare. But at the same time, I think it can be easy for any profession, whether it's lawyers or college professors or the media, anybody, doctors, to have performance breakdowns that can happen through no fault of any individual, but when you have incentives and cultures and organizational norms can lead over time sometimes to results that are not what anyone really wants. And so there are several things that can go on. First of all, doctors do want to help patients, and a lot of times they simply don't have the evidence that they need to make an evidence-based decision. And so, you know, you might actually want to know whether drug A is better than drug B versus surgery C, and oftentimes they don't know. And so they're operating literally under uncertainty. We are now having to spend some money through the Affordable Care Act. We've created a new agency, the PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, to provide more funding for some of these kinds of studies, which is very important. But in many cases, we don't have the information. So that's one thing. Oftentimes, even if they wanted to make more evidence-based decision, the information just isn't there. Secondly, when the information is there, sometimes it can contradict what, you know, people sort of see with their own eyes. So you might be a surgeon and you performed a surgery and the patients do feel better. It can be difficult psychologically for you to think that, you know, the patient might have improved for reasons other than the surgery. It might have been just due to the expectation of improvement due to the placebo effect or the natural history of the disease. If you might have arthritis, the patient came to see you at a time when their arthritis was in bad shape, but then it waxes and wanes, and so over time it would improve naturally. And so there can be lots of resistance to it. But then there is also economic incentives. You know, some doctors, we still operate on a fee-through-service basis, and a lot of U.S. medicine, we're trying to move away from that through bundled payments and other new payment schemes, but a lot of U.S. healthcare still has strong economic incentives. Some doctors own their own imaging offices and other kinds of medical technology that gives them a direct incentive. And then people tend to practice in many ways similar to people in their own region, in their geographical area. And so the norms there can be very strong. So for a variety of psychological reasons, organizational reasons, as well as economic reasons, the uptake of evidence and the integration of evidence into medicine can be less effective than we would hope. But then at the same time, there is, as you said, there are these medical societies. And I think what's important for people to see is that medical societies do operate on, they do serve the function of helping to educate their fellow members, and they do a lot of good work there. But in some ways, they also are interest groups. They are also, in some ways, trade associations. And what we found was a couple of things. First of all, the public does not really see medical societies that way. The public is, you know, used to thinking, well, the oil lobby is an interest group, or maybe pharmaceutical firms, but, you know, not the American Orthopedics Association. And so, you know, that is in some ways, I think, a misperception. The public doesn't realize that medical societies do also, you know, play that role. And then, as I said before, in our physician survey, something that I think was important and in some ways surprising, we found that doctors themselves are quite comfortable with their own societies advocating for the economic interests of doctors. And so they want the groups to play that role. And so, you know, in the American healthcare system, we have a tremendous amount of motivation motivation for concern for patient welfare, but economic incentives do swirl around there as well.
So let's start to explore more this idea of getting the evidence. You said a lot of times the evidence isn't available, and you mentioned PCORI, which is something that was implemented with the Affordable Care Act, but
yep.
its charter is running out in just a couple of years, and I'd like you to talk about that. I'd like you to just talk about who's best to do that. It seems like the government may be. Doctors themselves don't have the time to do it. The societies aren't probably going to do it. The drug companies and the medical product they're not going to do it. So maybe it is government and maybe academia.
Yeah, so I think it's important to separate the issue of medical research from the organization of our healthcare system. So you might want to Medicare for All system, or you might think that we should be better off with individual private insurance. Those are things that reasonable people can disagree about. Let's put that to the side. No matter what health insurance system you want, whether you want a collective system or you want an individual system, there's still the issue of generating information about the effectiveness of different treatments. And that information is what we would call a public good. It's something that the free market is not going to supply on its own. And so you really need taxpayer-funded subsidy to pay for those studies, because no insurance company is going to pay for those studies. They're very expensive, because if you did pay for them, the information would suddenly be available to your competitor, and you'd have no incentive to produce the information in the first place. And so given those features of this as a public good, we do need a government solution. And so the government is beginning to pay for some of those studies. But as you said, the agency that carries them out is only authorized to 2019, and it's not at all clear that it's going to last. The agency has not had much impact in practice so far. It remains controversial. There's still a lot of concern that the information could be used as a pretext for rationing care. And as we describe in the book, this reflects our polarized politics and some of the ways the U.S. political system is not working very well. The idea that we need better information about health care, that was not a Barack Obama idea. That was not originally a Democratic idea. That was a bipartisan idea of health care experts associated with Democrats and Republicans. Actually, one of the people that was most instrumental in pushing for this was a health economist named Gail Walensky, who had led the Medicare agency under George H.W. Bush. So this was something that was recognized by healthcare experts associated with both parties, that we really need a healthcare system that is more scientific and information-based. And what happened, though, was this very bipartisan idea of let's get better information about healthcare, treatment, so that patients and payers and providers will know what works best, that got wrapped up in the debate over the Affordable Care Act. It got put in that bill, as well as earlier in the stimulus bill in the aftermath of the Great Recession. And it became very politicized. And as the Republicans began attacking the Affordable Care Act, which they didn't like for its redistributive nature and for other reasons, they also began attacking this part of the bill because it was a convenient lightning rod. And so they began arguing that the ACA would be used to set death panels and to ration care, and that this agency, PCORI, and another agency, IPAB, and some other elements of the bill, they were all part and parcel of this sort of government takeover to try to ration care, even though the idea of better information about what works originally had nothing to do with insurance reform. And so it's sort of an unfortunate illustration of how U.S. politics is not working very well right now. Not only do the two parties disagree about things like the size of government or, you know, whether we should tax the rich or try to stimulate business more, those are things that progressives and conservatives might be disagreeing about, but even on issues like evidence-based medicine that previously had been ones that had bipartisan consensus, those two are now the source of conflict.
So what do you see as the way forward here, given the political climate? You've already said the government needs to play a role. It is a public good. We've talked about the doctors a little bit. They've got to play a role in this because they're the experts. And in fact, the study you mentioned about the osteoarthritis surgery, that was really instituted by a couple of doctors who were very much interested in it. So do you have a sense of the way forward with this? How are we going to move this along?
Yeah, so I think it's going to need a couple of things. First of all, we'll need physician leadership for sure. There are leaders within the medical profession who are playing a key role. There are thought leaders like Atul Gawande and others who are raising visibility. But one thing we found is that the message of these leaders that are more on the reform vanguard is not yet percolating down to the average doctor. In our doctor survey, we did a study to try to just understand how much does the average doctor understand these issues following them. And we found overwhelmingly, even though they have received attention in the policy debate, the average doctor doesn't know very much about these. So there's a real opportunity there for the leaders of medicine to educate their fellow doctors. That's going to be crucial, because until the average doctor who sees the average patient in Mendocino understands these issues, we're not going to make a lot of progress, and that's crucial. Secondly, I think, you know, for patients, it's important to become educated about these issues, to realize that a lot of medicine is not, in fact, based on strong evidence. And so when you see your doctor, you want to be an informed consumer. You want to ask not only, you know, what is the most common treatment or what the doctor's recommending, but what are the alternatives? What are the pros and cons of each option? There's been studies that show when patients receive that information, they sometimes will make different choices than they would initially. They often will choose a less invasive treatment, or they might be willing to tolerate a particular side effect as opposed to another side effect, because given their own preference, they care more about the former than the latter. And so patients themselves can play a key role. And then as voters, I think we want to support politicians that will take steps to improve the quality and efficiency of the healthcare system, including being willing to consider changes, to programs like Medicare and Medicaid, to give those programs more tools to reduce spending on healthcare that's not fully effective for patients, so that we can make sure we do as much good for people and we have as much value for money from these programs as possible.
And I'm going to ask a question you didn't actually cover in the book, but I just want to see if maybe you've got some ideas about it, because it comes up for me here. And this is this idea of we need good evidence-based medicine. What about all the misinformation that's out there? I know patients, if they're informed, they can make better choices. But if they're getting their information just through Google and then they take that to their doctor and they come in there with an existing belief about it, I have a sense from talking to my own doctor that they kind of face that every day as well.
Yes. So, I think there are sources. You can look at the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force that's reliable in a lot of services. You can look at the guidelines of leading medical societies for what they recommend. There are a variety of tools out there. You don't just have to Google sort of blindly. There are more reputable sources. And I think, with a little – and they vary, of course, by practice area. I won't be able to, share each of them, today during the interview. But you can identify – the average consumer can find more or less trustworthy sources of information. So I think that's very important as well. And you can just ask your doctor, what are the evidence-based guidelines from your specialty society? Is this consistent with that? And sometimes the doctor might say, and I think they would be honest and say, well, they might say X, but I think, you're a patient for whom this treatment might work, even though you're not the typical one. And maybe that's correct and maybe that's not, but at least you would know the doctor's giving you a recommendation that may or may not be consistent with the guideline. That's something to be keeping in mind as well.
So another avenue just to explore a little bit more, we're talking about evidence-based medicine, and you've also been talking about some of the costs. There's not always a direct connection there. Sometimes evidence-based medicine costs more, sometimes less.
Yes.
So it may or may not have an effect, total effect. You can talk about it in generally about the – you've mentioned already that we spend way more for less result.
Yes. I mean, the real concern about our book is about health, and it's about efficiency, value for money. I think, probably if we did a better job in having evidence-based medicine, we would eliminate some wasteful spending. That's important. There's definitely evidence of over-treatment. There's just been a recent study that was in the Journal of American Medical Association that found that physicians themselves report that more than 20% of overall medical care was not needed. But there are parts of medicine where we don't do enough. And if it turned out, you know, if there's a study that suggests that, you know, an expensive treatment works really well and we're underperforming it, well, we should do more of it. And so the book is really not about just, you know, cutting costs for its own sake. It's about better science. It's about better quality and a more efficient healthcare system and making sure that patients get the best treatments. It is definitely the case that there are many Americans, including some very well-insured Americans, who are getting too much medicine that, and sometimes are you know, exposing them to harm. But it's for sure also the case that there are effective treatments that are not reaching patients that that would be helped by them, and we need to do a better job of that as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Eric Potashnick, co-author of Unhealthy Politics, The Battle Over Evidence-Based Medicine. I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines. If you've got some questions for Professor Potashnick about this whole area of evidence-based medicine, please give us a call at 707-895-2448 or send your comments or questions to dj@kzyx.org. Again, that's 895-2448. While we're waiting to see if anybody calls in with some questions, let's get into this kind of Medicare and particularly this evidence that costs and the kind of care varies across regions. It's not something you would necessarily I do have a call coming in, so we'll hold off on that question and we'll just take the listener call if that's okay with you.
Sure thing.
Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Tom.
Go ahead.
Yes. It's real important, this efficacy question, because I've got severe asthma and I've tried all kinds of things. And I wonder if there is a location, a website or something that actually compares different methods and with their efficacy.
Yeah, you certainly could look at PCORI's website and you could see what studies they've done. Have you looked at the specialty society in your area and the guidelines in your practice area for asthma?
Let me just say that PCORI is P-C-O-R-I. It's an acronym, and so that listeners know that.
Yep.
.org. PCORI.org.
Yeah, that'd be a good place to look. And you know, I certainly think you can also call, you know, the medical society and ask them if they have guidelines available. Many of them would.
Is there a national one for asthma?
Oh, I'm sure. I don't know that off the top of my head, but for sure there would be. And there are patient groups as well. I think, you know, you do have to be careful. Sometimes these patient groups are funded by pharmaceutical firms and others, and they can have interest. So you have to do your homework. But I think, you know, with a little bit of homework and talking to a number of doctors and just asking them about the evidence base, the reality is a lot of doctors have never been asked by their patients. You know, oftentimes patients will go in and sort of say, what do you recommend or do you have something else? But a more educated patient can discuss with his or her doctor, can you talk to me about what the evidence base is? What are the studies? How effective is this? What percentage of patients are helped by this particular drug? How strong is the evidence base? Were the studies strong ones? How much uncertainty is there? And most doctors will be very glad to have that conversation. And I think we'll be honest and talk to you about where there is uncertainty and so you can make your own decisions as well. If you're dealing with an area where, there's less clear-cut evidence about them, you should make an informed decision with your physician about whether you want to use a particular drug.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So
well,
you were asking about the geographical variation issue.
Right, right.
Yeah, so this is, I think, one that is very important to understand, and it's something that I think a lot of Americans don't realize, and that is there's huge variation in how doctors treat patients with the same condition in different parts of the country. So it could be that, you know, you have back pain and you're living in San Francisco. I'm making this up as for an illustrative example, and you would get a surgery, but if you're living in Chicago, you know, you might get physical therapy, and if you're living in Detroit, that you might get a drug regimen first. That might be fine if we had a system in place to figure out which of these treatments works best for patients with the same condition. information, but we don't have a sort of effective way of learning that. And so as a result, you can see that, you know, differences in treatment protocols across geographical areas can persist for long periods of time without any system in place to figure out what works best. And that can have a couple of consequences. It could mean that, and this is for sure true in the Medicare program, that some parts of the country are spending way more on treatments for the same kind of patient mix than other parts of the country, and they might be producing outcomes that are no better. And so, you know, that suggests that there's inefficiency there. We should be able to do better. It could also mean that there might be a more effective treatment in one part of the country that isn't necessarily diffusing into practice in elsewhere in the same country. And, you know, I think that can be frustrating as well. And so we have a huge country, and it's not the case that our medical system is set up to learn quickly and effectively what treatments work best for patients with the same condition. Instead, we have a very fragmented system that can allow a variety of protocols to be used for long periods of time without any clear mechanism in place to identify which one works best.
It's going to take another call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Oasis.
Oasis, go ahead.
I was wondering if the research that they've been doing, your guest has been doing, applies also to causes of, you mentioned the back problem and so forth. If there's some consistency of that so that we can improve our health through mitigating causes of different conditions that we have. For example, sugar and diabetes. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
So I think that's outside the scope of the book about, you know, why do Americans have a variety of particular health conditions, heart disease or cancer or pain. There are a variety of causes, of course, from environmental to diet to all sorts of things. And those are for sure important issues. What I think is, the book is more about is the overall context in which American healthcare takes place. And we quote the medical ethicist Daniel Callahan in the book at the beginning, the introduction of the book, and he said, American healthcare is radically American. It's individualistic. It's scientifically ambitious. It's market intoxicated. It's suspicious of government, and it's profit-driven. And that is the overall setting in which our system, takes place. That is part of the reason why we have a system that could spend dramatically more than any other country, both in total and per capita, but not necessarily be superior across the board. In lots of areas, it looks like we are quite wasteful and inefficient. And the challenge is that if waste and inefficiency were just in one little corner of the healthcare system, it wouldn't be so hard to eliminate it. We could identify it. We could cut it out. The problem, as David Cutler, the economist from Harvard, has said, is that waste is marbled throughout our whole system. It's a little bit here. It's a little bit there. And it adds up. And it means that we are paying, more than we should be paying, given the outcomes that we get. It means that our quality is not as high as it should be. It means that people are exposed to treatments that might have side effects that they don't need, given that there might be safer alternatives. And it creates this problem of geographical variation, as you talked about. All of those are major problems. We're not unique in the world in having some of these problems. Other countries also struggle with waste and inefficiency and geographical variation. But we are unique in the degree to which our healthcare system is extremely fragmented, in the degree to which our medical societies are not well organized to identify the most effective treatments. We really diffuse authority over the healthcare system down to the individual encounter between doctors and patients. We eschew the kind of government budget controls and controls on the diffusion of technology that are used in other systems. All of that means that these problems that exist elsewhere are really intense in the U.S. healthcare system. So we have a extremely expensive system that, despite our advanced science, and we do have some advanced science, also means that too often patients are still receiving treatments that are not grounded in solid evidence.
I just want to make sure that listeners are aware you are not an MD. You're in
public
policy and political science, and so that's the context for this conversation. So, and besides, even if you were an MD, we wouldn't be giving out medical advice over the phone.
No, but I have absolutely no medical advice to give out. I want to be clear that, you know, if I, God forbid, you know, fall over during this radio interview, I want someone to call 911. This is not an anti-medicine book. I believe in medicine. I believe American medicine does a tremendous amount of good. There are some aspects of American healthcare that are best in class, best in the world, but it still is the case that we have big problems of waste and inefficiency and treatments that are not as grounded in strong science as they should be, and those contribute to problems of cost and quality and efficiency, and we can be doing a lot better than we are today.
It raises a question for me when you were talking about in kind of comparing our system to other countries' systems. Do some other countries do a better job of providing the evidence and finding the evidence, and might that be a resource for some of our listeners to look?
You could, yes. You could look at NICE, which is an agency in England, and they have evidence guidelines as well that you can read. You could look at a number of other agencies, but that one probably is the one that has done the most work in this area. That one, you know, I would say NICE is so controversial because NICE is, for many people, the symbol of the British healthcare system. They will actually come up with recommendations that will affect coverage decisions in the National Health Service. And one thing that we have done in the U.S. quite deliberately when we set up PCORI was to create a separation between the agency that does studies and actually coming up with recommendations that might influence, you know, coverage decisions or reimbursement decisions. So PCORI can do studies, but they're not allowed to recommend or mandate treatment decisions in the Medicare program, for example. And that is due to our aversion to government and to our fear of government interfering with the doctor-patient relationship. And, you know, that's very deeply seated in the United States. And there are good reasons why we set up PCORI that way to get it going, but it can also mean that Medicare really lacks the tools in order to eliminate care that is very expensive but doesn't have, you know, many patients for patients. And, you know, going forward, that's going to be a big struggle for the United States. Will we give our government and private insurers, which often follow the lead of the Medicare agency, more tools to say either they won't cover something that isn't based on sound science, or perhaps they might say to a patient, you know, you can still have this treatment, but if you want it, you have to pay more for it. You have to have a higher copay because the studies show that there's this other treatment that works just as well and it only costs, you know, a third as much. Will we as a society be more willing to move to that kind of world going forward? We've been very uncomfortable going there, but the result is that it means that our spending is extremely high.
Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Hi. My name's Nancy.
Go ahead, Nancy.
I want to know if your guest has any opinion on the workman's comp system.
I don't have any opinion on that, except to say that, you know, one of the things that we're seeing in the workers' comp and in Medicare and Medicaid is that a lot of people are dealing with issues of pain. They're dealing with issues of opioids. They're dealing with spinal and back and limb injuries. Those are ones where we really do need to strengthen our evidence base because there can be, you know, a lot of different procedures that a lot of different treatments to take care of patients with those conditions, you know, bad back, bad pain issues. We need to figure out which ones work best for patients and are safe as well. They're so common. We have so many Americans that are suffering from those conditions. It's really incumbent upon us to do a better job figuring out which ones work best. There's a lot of evidence, for example, that we have a lot of spinal surgery, spinal fusions, and some others that where the evidence base is not so strong. I have nothing but sympathy for Americans that are suffering from those kinds of physical ailments. As we age as a society, they're becoming increasingly frequent. We need to do a better job of learning what the costs and benefits and the pros and cons are of different treatments for them.
Thanks, Nancy.
Well, thank you. He's speaking to the choir here. I did not have a fusion, by the way.
Okay. I hope your back is okay.
I'm about to go get on my horse.
Oh, good.
It's not okay, but I don't take a lot of pain pills, and Workman's Comp was not happy with me, but I'm so much better off that I did not have a fusion.
Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Lamar.
Lamar, go ahead.
Hi. I think that the way we view doctors has to change, and the way the doctors view people or patients has to change. What I mean by that is perhaps in a socialist country, they're educated to see the doctor as just another human being, because what we have is an inequality, a polarization. The doctor is way up there, and as a superlative creature citizen, and the patient is this lowly worm down here. That inequality creates a divide that the patient feels that they have, that they can trust this doctor 100%, and that is not always the case. You cannot trust a doctor 100%.
Let's get Eric to respond to that, because I'm pretty sure he's got a response. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're raising a very good point. There are really good reasons why we have such faith in doctors, why we view them as agents of our welfare. Doctors are well trained. They take an oath to protect our interests. They know, you know, obviously infinitely more than the average patient about any given condition. There is what economists call an information asymmetry. They're much better informed. But at the same time, I think that the caller is quite right that, you know, we can trust blindly when we need to go in with our eyes open. Because doctors, even if well-trained and well-motivated, are also subject to incentives, and they're the product of their trainings, and they're the product of the norms in their practice environment. And we did studies that looked at how average Americans think about doctors, and we saw, you know, people really view doctors, I wouldn't quite say we put them on a pedestal, but we hold doctors in extremely high regard, not only higher than politicians and lawyers, but higher than teachers in some respects and other professions. And, you know, that can lead to problems where patients sometimes don't always ask the questions they need to ask. And it's not enough only to sort of get multiple opinions, because if you go to, you know, two doctors to get a second opinion, if you go to two doctors who, you know, are in the same practice area and you say, should I get treatment X? And they may well both say the same thing because, you know, most of the doctors in that area, you know, practice that way. A better question might be, what is the evidence for this treatment? What are the pros and cons? What are the other treatment alternatives? How should I think about, you know, choosing among them?
I'm trying to squeeze in another call here, Eric. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have a first name, please? You got to turn your radio off. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you so much. I have two comments, and I would like to get your reflection.
Make it quick because we're running down to the end.
Mother, and I've had three children at home and four in the hospitals. But the fact that our local hospital doesn't have a birth center is very troublesome to me. They have five operating rooms so that when people come to have a baby, they're brought into an operating table in which America has many more problems with infant mortality and the intrusion.
Randy, I'm going to have to ask you to get to the question because we're running out of time.
Okay, the other one is marijuana as an alternative or herbal. I don't know if you've covered that at all, but herbal medicines. I sprained my hand, and I've been using arnica and comfrey, and it's getting better. It's been 2 weeks now, and the pastor's wife had surgery on her broken hand with two plates put in and stitches, you know, at a cost of thousands of dollars. And there are alternatives to, you know, automatically assuming that surgery or that interference. Mm-hmm. And we all profit when everybody's, you know, healed.
Let's get Eric a chance to respond, Randy.
Where do we get this bridge between our hearts in our minds and science? And, you know, I pray in the name of Jesus. I'm a Christian Scientist. I went to school as a child.
Randy, I'm going to have to let you go.
Thank you, dear.
Thanks.
Take my
okay. So, I think one of the things that come out of the book is that a lot of people in traditional medicine, you know, sort of look down at alternative medicine, and they would argue, well, you know, those treatments have never really been proven scientifically. They haven't gone through FDA review. But this book and the evidence that it rests on should also be an eye-opener to people who believe in conventional medicine, and shows that actually a lot of conventional medicine also rests on a much weaker scientific base than we would think. And so the differences in sort of the level of evidence that exists between so-called conventional medicine and alternative medicine is often not as sharp as one would think. I think the issue is not whether something is labeled, you know, conventional or alternative, but, you know, does it help patients? How well does it work? And so, you know, I would say if there are treatments, whether herbal or otherwise, that, you know, might work well for patients, they should be tested, and they should go under, you know, double-blind review, and we should figure it out. And if it turns out that they work well, then that would be great. And so, you know, really what we should care about, I think, is not what something's labeled, but what makes, you know, cures patients, makes patients feel better, and protects quality and safety. And we need good information and good science to do that.
If you're just joining us, you're hearing the end of Consider This. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest has been Eric Potashnick, co-author of Unhealthy Politics, The Battle Over Evidence-Based Medicine. Eric, we're down to the end of the show. I'd like to give you an opportunity in the last 30 seconds or so to sum up, say anything you'd like to say in closing.
Well, first of all, it's been a pleasure to be on your show. I did my graduate work at Berkeley, spent a lot of time in Mendocino. It's a beautiful part of the country, so you're lucky to live there.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's been great talking to you. I think that the book is one that, you know, points out problems that really matter for ordinary people's lives. The issues about the Affordable Care Act are absolutely important, but sometimes I think we forget that the healthcare system is not only about insurance, it's also about what happens when you do see a doctor. And we have to make sure that those interactions between patients and doctors do as much good as possible. Healthcare in the United States is really expensive, and we all deserve the best possible care. In order to improve medicine, we're going to need better science, we're going to need better leadership from the medical profession, and we're going to need more informed public citizens.
Thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Bye-bye.